Think in Models, a structured approach to clear thinking and the art of strategic decision-making. Written by Nick Trenton, narrated by Russell Newton. The more and more you look at, well, the way you look at things, the more you'll realize just how difficult it really is to make significant shifts. This is because it's something none of us does automatically. Every day, you more or less trust the data coming in from your sense organs. You generally believe what you see and hear around you, and you have no reason not to take your own word for it as you tell yourself endless mental stories day after day. But it takes something extra, some deliberate and purpose-driven decision to be different, to switch us out of habitual autopilot behavior and into conscious and autonomous action. How do you see the world? What do you see, and what don't you see? Is what you're perceiving accurate or useful? How does your mental model influence the way you see? What effect does this have on your life, and do you like this outcome? You can never see things from another angle unless you're willing to acknowledge that you are currently viewing things from any angle in the first place. You can never dig deeper if you have entirely convinced yourself that you're already seeing all there is to see. In essence, our mental models tell us who we are, how the world works, and what's possible for us. Before you take that at face value, isn't it worth examining these mental models? Being clear-minded was the goal of the previous chapter, i.e., learning to divest ourselves of those obstacles that stand between us and the world we're trying to more properly understand. But simply being free of bias and self-delusion doesn't mean we automatically see reality perfectly. We also need to consider the quality and accuracy of the models we use, i.e., how well they allow us to interact with our world. We need to find out whether our way of looking at reality is justified. Does it actually work, in other words? We need to go back to the drawing board and remember why we have mental models in the first place. The problem is not in using models, but in using them incorrectly. Let's take a closer look at how we can consciously use our mental models rather than being unconsciously influenced by them. Distinguish the map from the territory. The teaching is merely a vehicle to describe the truth. Don't mistake it for the truth itself. A finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. The finger is needed to know where to look for the moon, but if you mistake the finger for the moon itself, you'll never know the real moon. The teaching is like a raft that carries you to the other shore. The raft is needed, but the raft is not the other shore. An intelligent person would not carry the raft around on his head after making it across to the other shore. Because my teaching is the raft which can help you cross to the other shore beyond birth and death. Use the raft to cross to the other shore, but don't hang on to it as your property. Do not become caught up in the teaching. You must be able to let it go. Thich Nhat Hanh. The concept that the map is not the territory is an old sentiment, one that's been expressed by many in various ways, including by philosophers, entrepreneurs, and Tibetan Buddhists like Thich Nhat Hanh. The idea is simple. The description of a thing, or the symbols we use for it, or any abstraction or model we use to try to understand it, is not the thing itself. Every time you use a psychological model to understand someone's behavior, a mental model to understand your own behavior, or even a scientific or religious framework to understand the world around you, you're using a map. Maps are necessarily simplified abstractions of much larger, more complex phenomena, and there's nothing wrong with using them. In fact, it's hard to imagine a world where we don't use these intellectual tools to analyze and make sense of our experience. The trouble is not in using a map, but in forgetting that it's just that, a picture of reality, and not reality itself. The world out there, and to be fair, in here, can be a frighteningly complicated thing, and you could be forgiven for coming to rely too heavily on maps, even ones that don't work particularly well. Maps are representations of the world, but they are not the world. Furthermore, a map is only correct as far as it is useful in allowing us to explain and interpret what we see in reality. The danger is in holding the image as more significant than the thing it's meant to portray. Here's an example. All software engineers are nerdy guys. Well, I'm a software engineer, and I'm not a nerd. Plus, I'm a woman. Sure, I guess, but then you're not a real software engineer. When we cling to a map of how the world is, for example, the belief that all software engineers are nerdy guys, but find it actually doesn't represent reality all that well, for example, discovering a non-nerdy female one, we should rightly adapt the model or else throw it away entirely. Unfortunately, many of us choose to stick with the map despite the evidence and try to reinterpret reality so that it fits the map better. For example, claiming that your belief is still correct and the female non-nerdy software engineer is a fluke or outlier or not even a software engineer at all. Sometimes these maps can be useful general rules of thumb. The psychologist Dan Ariely has talked about how we do not have the cognitive power to analyze and conceptualize everything from scratch, and so we use general rules to help reduce the load on our brains. So when we come across a software engineer, we assume they're nerdy guys, because that's been our general observation, making it likely that our assumption is true. However, remembering that the map is not the territory is a smart way to keep cognizant of the fact that you're using mental models in the first place and that these models can and should adapt or be used according to where they fit the best. We can take something to be generally true without assuming that it is always so. That way, we keep an open mind while retaining the benefits of these rules of thumb. One obvious problem could be that your map is wrong. The entire premise of cognitive behavior therapy, for example, is that the cognitive maps you use are no longer accurately reflecting reality and need an update. When you remind yourself that the thoughts you have about reality are not the same as reality, you put yourself in the supremely empowered position of being able to change them. You can then work on devising maps that are more accurate or choose ones that are more useful in getting you the results you want. Maps are not just on the individual scale, of course. Over the millennia, countless old and obsolete maps were used and then discarded. The idea that the Earth is at the center of the universe, the idea that disease is caused by bad odors in the air, or the idea that women's wombs would shrivel if they studied too hard, for example, by taking up a career in software development. Another more serious problem is that your map is simply incomplete. Eric Sandberg-Dement wrote in 1985 in the New York Times, "But the real future of the laptop computer will remain in the specialized niche markets, because no matter how inexpensive the machines become, and no matter how sophisticated their software, I still can't imagine the average user taking one along when going fishing." In this now amusing failed prediction, the key words are obvious. I still can't imagine. A map is frequently fixed and unchanging and may well represent a picture of reality already past. A mental model is our best guess for explaining how things work right now, given everything we know. Unfortunately, a map can never be smarter than we are, and it will contain all the biases and blind spots that we do. Many people routinely fail to predict game-changing events because the models they have of the world are simply too small. They're incomplete and based on the limited knowledge they have in that moment. The trouble in holding a little too tightly to the map you have of the world is you just might miss amazing new information as it flies by you, blinded because you expected something different. The map, being an imperfect reflection of reality, is only meant to be temporary. Giving it a more permanent status will only lock you into ways of thinking that may not work. Remembering this fact will mean you routinely give yourself the opportunity to step outside your perceptions and assumptions and reevaluate the mental shortcuts you use to make sense of life. What's the alternative to using a map to understand the territory? Simple. Travel the territory for real in person. Trust your own direct experience before you trust a map, if possible. Real lived experience is incomparable. When you immerse yourself in reality as far as possible, really see it, feel it, taste it, and become curious about what it is without rushing in to explain it too quickly, your perceptions are greatly enriched. How many times have you taken someone else's opinions as fact? How many times has someone else told you how the world is or how it works, and you accepted it without ever giving yourself a chance to verify this for yourself? Obviously, direct experience isn't always possible, but it may nevertheless be useful to once in a while entertain a little doubt in the models you hold dear. What if you have an opinion right now that's as short-sighted as Eric Sadberg Dement's views about computers? Paradoxically, the only way you can get closer to accurate, high-quality models of the world around you is to be willing to frequently question the ones you have and to drop those that aren't carrying their weight. A map is necessarily a mere shadow of the thing it's pointing to. If a map were as big and complex as the world it was trying to explain, then it wouldn't be useful to us anymore as a model. Many people look to various maps of the world as though they were carved in stone. But consider that even seemingly rock-solid scientific theories, like gravity or general relativity, are models in precisely the same way as the idea that the universe revolves around the Earth was a model. For a time, this geocentric assumption really did help explain the observed movement of the heavenly bodies. Our models today may well be better, and they may have more power in explaining phenomena around them, but several theoretical physicists have had success describing and understanding our universe using other, equally useful models. For some great thinkers, the entire construct of science itself is merely an admittedly useful paradigm that humans are particularly fond of at this point in history. Science may fail to help us explain or understand certain psychological phenomena, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. That would be the mistake of trying to fit reality to match the map. Rather, another, different map can be used to help us make sense of the psychological territory. It's rather like needing one kind of map for exploring deserts and an entirely different one for exploring the depths of the ocean. Remembering that the map is not the territory is a simple but powerful way to remind yourself of why you're using mental models in the first place. Not to replace reality, but as a temporary tool to better understand it. You can use this principle in practically every area of your life. The next time you're facing some difficult problems or have trouble making sense of your choices or limitations, ask yourself these questions. What assumptions are you making about what you're experiencing? Have you told yourself a story that explains your situation? And is this story strictly accurate? In understanding that you're using a mental map, do you understand the map's limitations, or have you been acting as though it had none? When you observe the world around you, do you often find information that conflicts with your pet theories? What does this say about the quality of your models? By asking yourself these questions, you step outside of your mental models for a while to appraise their performance in your life. Let's consider an example. Maybe you've always been interested in psychological theories and have a bit of a habit of diagnosing those around you in an attempt to understand their behavior. Let's say you've come out of a particular distressing breakup and now you view your ex in a very specific way. You feel that they were, in fact, a psychopath and targeted you because you were a kind-hearted person. You build a narrative around this diagnosis. You look at their behavior and explain it in terms of a grand psychological theory that checks all the boxes of a cruel, calculating individual who lacks empathy. You probably can imagine that there are some powerful defense mechanisms at play here, but for now, let's just look at this map you're using to make sense of this painful breakup. When you see evidence of your ex demonstrating remorse, which would suggest they weren't a psychopath, you decide that this is actually them displaying an incredible ability to lie and manipulate, which would suggest that they were a psychopath. When your ex apologizes and tries to reconnect, you see evil intent. They're obviously trying to control you. But then when they eventually move on, you interpret this as proof that they are cold-hearted and never wanted to give the relationship a real chance. This may all seem very obvious when laid out this way, but many people do some version of the above with very little self-awareness. Let's consider the questions above. What are the assumptions being made, and is the story strictly accurate? If the person in our example is honest with themselves, they would see that they've gone far beyond assumptions and into a foregone conclusion. They've made their decision about what's true and are looking for evidence after the fact to support their belief. The story may or may not be accurate, but only a professional can make that diagnosis. And anyway, what does it matter if they are a psychopath? Our person could ask whether there were any limitations in their chosen map, i.e., the model where they pathologize their ex using trendy psychological concepts. Of course, they can only do this if they're aware that a model is being employed in the first place. Again, honesty and self-awareness might allow our person to see that there are several competing and more elegant theories to explain the behavior, i.e., people behave poorly sometimes when relationships end, or even the simpler, my ex is just a jerk. The psychopath concept is one that is heavily criticized and debated, even amongst professional psychologists and psychiatrists. A good clue is that psychopath itself is not a recognized mental disorder in the DSM, but something you're more likely to see on a true crime TV series. Finally, is there any information that conflicts with the chosen model? Here we can remember Darwin's golden rule and get real about whether challenges to our dominant worldview have some merit. This would be all the evidence that is selectively ignored or twisted, such as the ex demonstrating remorse and empathy. Of course, you won't always be showered with counter-evidence every time you hold a less-than-ideal mental map of the world, and often you may be actively praised for it. We don't even need to list examples here, but it's good practice to nevertheless keep your eyes open for evidence, even and especially evidence that you don't like. The above line of questioning can be understood as a rudimentary form of experiment. It's the habit of testing our assumptions and exposing them to different treatments to see the outcome. Does our mental model stand up to scrutiny? Does it work in context A as well as it does in context B? Why or why not? We look a bit more closely at this experimental way of thinking in the next section. The value of conducting thought experiments. There was a time when mankind knew so much less about the world. We take so much of what's around us as a given, forgetting where it came from. Look around you, and you'll see that almost everything was, at some point, discovered or created by some enterprising or curious human being. The devices you use daily, the symbols making up the language you're reading right now, the mechanics of the electricity powering your home, all the medical marvels that went into keeping you alive and well in this moment. Ignore the fact that someone once had to look at a cow and decide, I'll try to drink whatever comes out of those pink things. Each of these accomplishments had to be fought for and won, one tiny step at a time. Much of what our modern world is made of comes directly from the diligent effort of people working to understand the universe and create their own inventions. All this scientific and technological progress was made not simply by sheer force of will or strength, but by using the scientific method and prioritizing rational arguments founded on sound empirical or logical data. In other words, the experiment is a mental tool so immense, so valuable, and so central to the survival of our species that it's hard to imagine where we'd be without it. It takes us from point A to point B, and it lets us know that we are directly affecting the world we inhabit. Instead of cowering in the face of the unknown, Experiments allow you to systematically and logically ask questions of the world around you and make sense of the answers. It's a tool to gradually pull back ignorance and reveal useful facts and information, unearth new possibilities, or show us where we've made an error. Of course, in this classical view, you may be thinking of the quintessential experiment, a scientist in a lab poking around with test tubes or wires, or a clinical trial for a new medication. The truth is, we conduct experiments all the time, formally and informally, consciously and unconsciously. Anytime we deliberately manipulate conditions around us and carefully note the outcome, we're doing an experiment. Granted, not every experiment is going to be rigorous or perfectly sound. Nevertheless, experimentation is a method of patterning and understanding our encounters with the world. The concept behind this book is that some of the best experiments can be done with nothing more than your mind. Eons ago, humans had to learn things the hard way. If you wanted to know if a berry was poisonous or not, you ate it and hoped for the best. But if you survived, everyone could learn from your actions without having to incur any risk themselves. Gradually, people could build on what they already knew so that less and less had to be done concretely out there in the world. Thought experiments are conducted in a similar spirit. If we explore new ideas, arguments, and scenarios mentally rather than literally, we're freed from so many limitations. What would be impossible or impractical to do physically is accomplished with nothing more than careful thought. Thought experiments are not subject to any moral or natural laws, can be done relatively quickly, and have, for the most part, no real-world consequences. Their strength is that they give us the opportunity to fully flesh out certain hypothetical possibilities without committing to them practically. They allow us to discover aspects of ourselves we might not have otherwise, and consider the ramifications of certain possible acts long before we're technologically capable of them. There are countless innovators who, if asked where their inspiration came from, will point to speculative sci-fi from centuries prior, or whimsical what-if questions that spurred their curiosity. The thought experiments we'll be exploring in this book have all served a particular purpose in their historical context. However, in learning about them, we teach ourselves to reach outside our own habitual thoughts and beliefs. What philosophy in general, and thought experiments in particular, can teach us is twofold. Firstly, that we are inhabiting a way of thinking at all, and secondly, that our way of thinking can be changed. As you read on, the hope is that you'll develop your own critical thinking skills, mental agility, and self-awareness. You'll get comfortable thinking about thinking, perhaps the most valuable and transferable skill there is. By learning to carefully consider the virtues and drawbacks of the very process of thinking itself, you give yourself the opportunity to spot bias, question assumptions, more deeply understand your beliefs, and, if you're lucky, open the door to a completely new idea. Thought experiments are like a grand arena where you can take your brain out to play, to explore, and to learn about itself, to grow larger and more robust. The ability to see not just what is, but also what could be, is fundamental to any endeavor that requires creativity or problem-solving acumen. It also helps you shift perspectives if necessary, and consider something we seldom do, that we might be wrong. Manipulating thoughts, information, multiple variables, and coming up with an answer, for which there is no true right or wrong, a learned ability in itself, is something that can be applied to every walk of life. Throughout history, thought experiments have allowed great thinkers and philosophers to see beyond their immediate grasp, to ask far-ranging questions, and push the limits of human knowledge. Using thought experiments in your own life will make you a more focused, robust thinker with a cognitive and intellectual scope far wider than if you'd never challenged yourself in this particular way. Finally, perhaps the most important benefit to engaging in thought experiments is that you give yourself the chance to chew over questions for which there simply isn't an answer, even with infinitely advanced scientific, technological, or philosophical tools. Training your brain to confidently engage with these sorts of questions is enriching beyond the quick satisfaction of solving a problem or optimizing what you already know. So let's look a little closer. What exactly constitutes a thought experiment? Is it merely a question, simply asking, what if? Well, yes and no. The spark of wonder and curiosity is certainly the beginning, but a well-conducted thought experiment is also about the careful analysis of your answer, of other people's answers, and how to interpret them. A big part of a thought experiment is thoroughly considering the consequences and implications of certain conditions, actions, or choices. It's along the lines of, what happens if such and such is true? Thought experiments are completely fabricated conditionals. They are fictions which can obliquely bring us around to truths, or at the least, illuminate our limitations, assumptions, or errors. A truly great thought experiment often spurs further questions, a sign that your mind is mentally exploring an entirely new theoretical space. You may come across surprising answers and the opportunity to completely change your worldview without the bother of having to actually do anything. Thought experiments require us to apply our imagination, to entertain hypotheticals, and to follow through potential outcomes and ramifications without actually trying them out for real. When people encounter new scientific, political, or cultural developments, they extrapolate and may start to think about possible future worlds. For instance, what would it look like if the DNA for every plant was owned by a corporation? If we take some commonly held tenets and follow them to their full conclusion, where do we land? In our mind's eye, we see our best guess of the outcome or a predicted conclusion modeled on what we know now. We take our time to contemplate circumstances that aren't the case, can never be the case, or which we don't wish to be the case. Essentially, a thought experiment allows us to carry out tests, but in the laboratory of our minds. The problem of the runaway trolley. Consider a seemingly simple hypothetical situation. You're watching a train that's headed right for five people tied to the tracks, who will certainly be killed if the train continues. If you pull a lever, the train will divert and head down another track, killing instead just a single person tied to that track. So if you fail to act, five people die. But if you do act, only one person dies. The question is, would you pull the lever? Why? Now, the idea is not to say that would never happen, so who cares? The situation obviously is contrived, but it forces us to think outside the box and take a closer look at our default mental models. It invites us to have a conversation beyond what is immediately and concretely in front of us. Simply by asking the question, you've participated in one of philosophy's classic thought experiments, the so-called trolley problem. You may be spurred to think all kind of new thoughts, strengthening different modes of reasoning, just as an athlete trains different muscles of their body. You may wonder if we think a single life is important, does this imply that five lives are five times as important? Here, you're grappling with utilitarianism. You may believe most people would act to minimize harm if given the chance, considering what you know of how people normally behave, deductive reasoning. Or you may wonder if not acting in this case completely absolves a person of guilt. Now you're thinking about moral philosophy. You may wonder, what if the single person was your child or parent? What if you had to physically push a person in front of the train to stop it? What if each of the five people had cancer and was going to die within the next year? What if there were five babies, yet the lone person standing was akin to Albert Einstein or some other genius? What if you had the power to sacrifice yourself in their places? What plea would you make if you were the single person? Now you're practicing switching perspectives and views. If you ask yourself whether saving a family member versus a stranger is any more ethical, you're actively seeking and evaluating support for this argument. You might think the whole situation over and decide that it's implicitly acceptable to do wrong if it prevents a larger wrong from occurring. Congratulations, you've made a hypothesis. You could test this hypothesis, not an opinion, by asking whether pulling the lever should result in being punished by the law. You could make a prediction about what would happen if this was actually the case in the real world, and on and on. As you can see, one hypothetical situation can stimulate a whole new world of critical thinking in every direction. In fact, people have been chewing over the trolley problem for years, teasing apart what it can tell us about how humans think about culpability, the value of human life, moral behavior and psychology, the limits of a utilitarian approach in philosophy, and more. Many variants have been dreamt up, too. For example, what if the single person was a villain? While such thought experiments might seem glib and perhaps a little unsettling, they do serve a useful purpose. Philosophers use these hypothetical situations to investigate what beliefs we hold to be true, and as a result, what kind of knowledge we can have about ourselves and the world around us. Sometimes that process will be a little bizarre or unpleasant, but sometimes it can also push us beyond our limits and open up new and different perspectives. Long story short, thought experiments teach us to think. Mastering second-order thinking. When faced with the need to make a decision, most of us only consider the immediate impact that decision will have, especially if it's a time-sensitive or urgent one. We think in terms of one domino ahead, yet real life is never so simple and quarantined. What about the rest of the dominoes? They don't simply disappear. We perceive most of our everyday decisions as isolated situations that don't have a ton of consequences, positive or negative. We practice a disturbing lack of foresight on a daily basis because that's how we're biologically wired as humans, and yet our instincts don't serve us very well here. Typical human thinking cannot be faulted. I step on a nail and I jump to the side in pain and end up falling off a cliff. It just happens. This is generally known as first-order thinking, and it's where we focus exclusively on resolving a question or decision at hand and don't consider the more long-lasting ramifications or how our decision will play out in the distant future. If it helps, call it first domino thinking. The problem with this mode of thinking is that it is largely based on intuition, emotions, and convenience. The goal of first-order thinking is instant gratification, and sometimes this can be really useful. If you want to figure out what to eat for breakfast when you're in a rush, where to meet a friend, or which suit to wear to the office, this type of thought saves us from overanalyzing and allows us to make a choice quickly. As such, first-order thinking is useful when there isn't a bad choice you can make. You can meet your friend at a diner, at one of your houses, maybe at a bar. It doesn't really matter. Similarly, if you're picking a suit to wear to work, it's hard to go wrong. Many of our decisions, however, especially the ones we toss and turn over at night, have consequences that extend beyond what we can see right before us. In terms of consequences, humans are as blind as bats. Small decisions one might make could lead to effects down the road they didn't foresee, resulting in a sort of butterfly effect. The outcome isn't limited to the immediate changes we've decided upon. Other people or situations can be affected as well. Some of them may have been truly unpredictable, and some might be invisible until they rear their ugly heads. Others, though, only catch us by surprise because we didn't think the situation through quite deeply enough. Okay, you've heard enough about what not to do, so what should we do? Visualize all the dominoes, otherwise known as second-order thinking. This is simply trying to project into the future and extrapolate a range of consequences that you can use to conduct a cost-benefit analysis for your decisions or solutions. Instead of merely being satisfied about buying a new apartment, think about what it means for your credit, debt, and ability to own a huge dog in the future. Instead of bleaching your hair every week, consider that your bald spots have been increasing due to the harsh bleach, and that a toupee may soon be necessary. Second-order thinking has the usual effect of making you think twice about what you're doing and helps eliminate rash decisions, as you might expect when you consider the prolonged aftermath of your choices. It's the practice of seeking out as much information as possible to make measured decisions. What's the first domino to fall after a decision? Now, what are the three paths that first outcome can lead to, and where do those lead? You simply don't stop your analysis once the most obvious situations are articulated. Instead, you consider as many long-term possible ramifications as you can. How will your decision cause other dominoes to fall? If you tip this domino, which other dominoes will you be unable to tip because of time or effort? Opportunity cost. Famous investor Howard Marks provides a dead simple way this can apply to daily life. A good example can be seen in the hypothetical newspaper contest John Maynard Keynes wrote about in 1936. Readers would be shown 100 photos and asked to choose the 6 prettiest girls, with prizes going to the readers who chose the girls readers voted for most often. Naive entrants would try to win by picking the prettiest girls, but note that the contest would reward the readers who chose not the prettiest girls, but the most popular. Thus, the road to winning would lie not in figuring out which were the prettiest, but in predicting which girls the average entrant would consider prettiest. Clearly, to do so, the winner would have to be a second-level thinker. The first-level thinker wouldn't even recognize the difference. This can be carried one step further to take into account the fact that other entrants would each have their own opinion of what public perceptions are. Thus, the strategy can be extended to the next order and the next, and so on, at each level, attempting to predict the eventual outcome of the process based on the reasoning of other agents. It is not a case of choosing those faces that, to the best of one's judgment, are really the prettiest, nor even those that average opinion genuinely thinks the prettiest. We've reached the third degree, where we devote our intelligences to anticipating what average opinion expects the average opinion to be. And there are some, I believe, who practice the fourth, fifth, and higher degrees. Keynes, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, 1936. Think about it this way. Very rarely does something happen with no chain of events to follow. It's your job to look past the positive reinforcement and gratification you may receive, which frankly may be blinding you, and understand what could go wrong, how wrong it could go, and why it might have a negative outcome. What if you viewed each decision as having the potential to topple 15 other dominoes and then set about identifying them? Tedious, yet informative. Second-order thinking allows you to project the totality of your decisions. Even if you don't change your decision because of what you determine through second-order thinking, you think through 10 times as many scenarios and thus make far more informed choices than you would otherwise. Sometimes, that's the best we can do as a person. We can't predict the future, but we can't not think about it. If second-order thinking's so great, then why doesn't everybody do it? Because it's hard. Most of us do not want to spend the time to consider all the pros and cons of an action. We want to do what feels right and seems like it'll help us achieve our end goal. Humans aren't a shining example of doing the right thing on a consistent basis. Just look at our diets and how much money the weight loss industry generates on an annual basis. Questioning how our actions will affect situations beyond what's right in front of us takes probing into the unknown and leads one into a labyrinth of thinking that can be strenuous or complicated. Other people might say we're overthinking a decision or problem. The fact is, second-order thinking allows you to think clearly, at least more clearly than your competition. Most of the time, that matters. Nobody ever rises above the average through making the obvious choices or accepting the most convenient, simplest answers. Being able to project and foresee happenings on a deeper, futuristic level is a hallmark of successful people and almost always turns out to be worth the extra effort. Adopting this mental model will improve your decision-making and stop letting things slip through the cracks. To think in a second-order fashion, Howard Marks provided some guiding questions. How broadly will this decision affect things in the future? What will your decision do beyond change your immediate concerns? What new concepts will be created? Will your decision's purpose be fulfilled? Which result do I think will happen? Think beyond the simple resolution of the most immediate problem. If you take this course of action, what effect will it have if it succeeds or fails? What do those outcomes look like? What do semi-success and semi-failure look like? This naturally leads to the next question. What are the chances that I will succeed or be right? From as objective a standpoint as possible, what's the probability that your assessment is accurate? Is your prediction realistic, or at least a little steeped in fantasy or paranoia? Every decision has a cost-benefit ratio to it. Are you too openly courting failure or semi-failure? What does everybody else think? Hopefully you have access to at least one or two people, optimally more, who will give you an honest opinion about your prediction and whether they think you're on the right track or not. Although you shouldn't be unduly swayed by popular opinion, it's beneficial to know how your forecast is received. Consensus in numbers isn't generally something to strive for, but on the other hand, a complete lack of touch with reality is usually arrived at alone, with no second opinions, so you're really just trying to prevent the latter. How is what I think different from everyone else? What are the prime splitting points between what you think and what popular knowledge and opinion dictates? What specific aspects of your information and prediction are different, and why? What are they based on? What could you be missing? And again, this line of question naturally leads to the final point. What dominoes do other people visualize falling? Regardless of whether you actually have someone to bounce your ideas off of, the point of this last question is to step out of your own biased perspective and view decisions as other people would. Actively seek out and articulate the domino chain that other people might visualize and see how the dominoes fall from their perspective. Not all perspectives are valid, but this tactic gives you more information to ultimately help you make the right choice. Remember, this mental model's purpose is to expose and inform. We can't circumvent our human instinct of jumping to conclusions and deciding on a whim entirely, but we can be a bit more methodical about decision factors. This mental model very well could have been named Ignore the Monkey's Paw, but that seemed unnecessarily morbid, so instead, I'll just briefly recount the origins of the monkey's paw, and you can decide for yourself which title is more effective in forcing you to examine secondary consequences. The Monkey's Paw is a short story written by W.W. Jacobs in 1902. It's about a man who finds a blessed, or cursed, monkey's paw, which will grant him three wishes. Little does the man know that even though each wish will be technically fulfilled, there will be harsh consequences. For his first wish, the man wishes for $200. The next day, his son is killed at work, and the company gives the man $200 as payment. For his second wish, he wishes for his son back. In a short amount of time, he hears a knock at the door, and when he peers outside, he discovers that it is his son's mutilated and decomposing body. Frightened beyond belief, his third wish is for his son to disappear. Unintended consequences matter. Perspective is a tool. Thought experiments, second-order thinking, and learning to distinguish between the map and the territory are all valuable tools in the meta-inventory you can use to master your grip on reality. You may have noticed that much of what has been discussed in this chapter overlaps in interesting ways. For example, the psychological affects the cognitive, which then impacts the decisions taken and actions made, which feeds back into the psychological. Many of the approaches we've discussed above come with their own implied worldview and attitude, and in fact, we can approach many of these tools from either their mental or intellectual aspects, or their psychological and attitudinal ones. Mental models, then, are not just cognitive tools, but complete tools of perception. In changing our mindset and emotional landscape, our thoughts and perspective changes. In altering our thinking process, we see our emotions and beliefs adjust in turn. Rather than seeing your personality, outlook, or overall character as something fixed and non-negotiable, you can start to look at it as a large, complex lens to view your world through. For example, we've already alluded to the perspective of the scientist when we discussed thought experiments. A scientist's attitude is to encounter the unknown with curiosity and a drive to master uncertainty by gaining understanding. A scientist seeks to know why and how phenomena unfold as they do, and their perspective is a miniature, internalized version of the scientific method in general. A controlled experiment sets up two or more conditions and manipulates one or more identified variables to then observe the outcome. Using logic, inferences can be drawn about the conditions, the groups tested, or the action taken by the scientist. In this way, hypotheses, which are essentially formal questions asked of the unknown, are supported or disproven. In fact, proving and disproving are not symmetrical. Science proceeds solely by proving the null hypothesis, evidence that the ego and wanting to be right has no place in the scientific method. But none of this is to say that scientists are the ultimate arbiters of reality. Other viewpoints may be just as useful or more so. The artist's perspective, for instance, prioritizes creativity. Artists don't identify variables and try to control for them. They're not concerned with constraints of any kind. They want to explore and innovate, play, create, and do the unexpected. Uniqueness and beauty are undoubtedly the right lenses to use for some of life's problems, as evidenced by the fact that our greatest leaders are seldom described as in-the-box thinkers. There are countless perspectives. You could think like an engineer, a businessman, a parent, an investigative journalist, a doctor, a historian, a mathematician, a programmer, a comedian, an art critic, a philosopher, or an economist, God forbid. Rather than anyone being more correct or valid than the others, it's more about choosing just the right color palette for the picture you want to paint, from an artist's perspective anyway. You could opt for the perspective of a designer or architect. This is the mindset that looks at the unknown and asks what it could potentially be. People using this approach build and develop new things, first by making scale models of the vision they want to create, and then tackling the details to bring their dream to life. This is an active, purposeful, and future-oriented perspective that's not concerned with understanding or appreciating so much as it is with making. Like the artist, designers play with concepts to find new possibilities, but they do so with an eye to ending up with a real-world result. This is an empowering mindset to adopt when you want to fully explore your agency, take charge, and find practical solution inside the parameters you're given. Or you could forget about all of that and direct your conscious attention to something else entirely, the inner worlds of others. If you have the perspective of a teacher, psychologist, or even politician, a working model of what's going on in other people's minds is essential. This ability to understand that others occupy a completely different set of mental models is called theory of mind. Salespeople, too, need to understand and even anticipate other people's needs and desires and know how to speak to them. Teachers make a model of where their students' current understanding is and adjust their communication to help them comprehend what they currently don't. Psychologists use models of their own to understand essentially the models of others. And, in fact, much of the material in this book was written from within this perspective. Understanding all these different possible perspectives has two advantages. Firstly, you're less likely to get stuck in any particular one and lose sight of other possibilities. And secondly, you give yourself almost endless scope to see and engage with your world. Think of it as handles on reality. Which mental model or perspective is the right one? The one that gets you the result you want. In the beginning of our book, we spoke about the difference between crystallized versus fluid intelligence and how it's not what you know but how you think. Rather than learning facts, i.e. gathering data or knowledge, you equip yourself with something more flexible and useful, different ways of seeing. As you encounter novel solutions in life, you don't need to scan for any stored information. You don't need to have any experience or expertise at all. You simply need to be proficient at inhabiting the most useful mental model or way of thinking in the moment. If you can do this, you've achieved the most valuable thing of all. You have learned how to learn. Takeaways. It's not enough to remove obstacles to clear our thinking. We also need to make sure that the way we appraise reality is actually accurate. A mental model is a representation of reality, but the map is not the territory, and we need to remember that models are necessarily simplified. We need to consistently examine our model's limitations and assumptions by asking ourselves questions and following Darwin's golden rule. Once we find that our model is incomplete, we must take active steps to stop using the same mode of thinking. Thought experiments are a useful tool for thinking about our beliefs, assumptions, and various hypotheses we come up with while tackling routine issues in our lives. They can help us hypothetically test out our assumptions and follow through on hypotheses set by our models. The way we do this is by taking our beliefs and assumptions to their logical conclusion and critically examining everything that is implied or follows from the line of thought we considered in our experiment. There are two levels of thinking, first and second order thinking. First order thinking is largely superficial and seeks to resolve or answer any question or issue we face based on our intuitive leanings. Second order thinking entails seeing consequences and possibilities beyond the immediate present, especially during decision making. In the former, the goal is simply to make a choice, whereas in the latter, it is to make an informed, well thought out one. Different perspectives and worldviews are tools to help us achieve our goals. We can adopt the mindset of an artist, scientist, psychologist, designer, etc., to help us access different aspects of reality. Each has its virtues when used consciously. This has been Think in Models, a structured approach to clear thinking and the art of strategic decision making. Written by Nick Trenton, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2020 by Nick Trenton. Production copyright by Nick Trenton.